From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now. President Biden is asking Congress to more than double the funding to support Ukraine in its war against Russia. Some of the $33 billion he's asking for would be used to ease global economic stress. Here he is speaking at the White House today.
We're working with other nations like Korea, Japan, Qatar, and others to support our effort to help European allies threatened by Russia with gas, blackmail, and their energy needs in other ways. Aggression will not win.
Europe is bracing for a future without Russian energy. Yesterday, Moscow shut off natural gas to Poland and Bulgaria. Let's turn now to Ali Velshi, anchor and economics correspondent at MSNBC. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jane.
Most of the money the president is asking for will go to help Ukraine's military, but some would also be used to increase U.S. production of wheat and soybeans. Do you think this spending will do much to ease the stress on the global economy?
Well, I think it's important that you just played that clip from President Biden, because what he's talking about is that other countries are also going to have to get involved. So it's a good amount of money. It's not enough to offset the inflation, the higher prices of energy. About $20 billion of the $33 billion is going to military stuff. Some of that's going to Ukraine. Some of it's going to U.S. military efforts in the region, European security, NATO allies. You know, we've kept moving equipment closer and closer to Ukraine. Well, that's U.S. equipment. So that's where some of that money is going. About $8.5 billion is going to the Ukrainian economy, which, of course, is completely crippled by the fact that there's no travel in and out, there's no tourism, a lot of businesses stopped. So that's part of it. And then, as you said, about $3 billion is going around the globe to subsidize wheat, which has become more expensive because Ukraine is such a big producer of it. And there's also money going towards small and medium-sized American agricultural businesses during the fall harvest because natural gas prices are higher as a result of what's going on over there. So it's a very broad-based $33 billion, not enough to offset everything that's gone wrong, but probably a leadership role with partner countries who will do similar things.
So yesterday, Russia, of course, halted natural gas to Poland and Bulgaria because they will not pay for it in rubles. Those countries don't rely on Russian natural gas as much as other larger economies do. So how much risk is there to Europe's economy if Russia keeps going and cuts off natural gas to companies like, to countries like Germany or even Italy?
Yeah, so Poland years ago, when it as it became a bigger, sort of more economically developed country, it built natural gas receiving ports. So it's actually got them. It gets natural gas from anyone who can ship it to their ports. Germany, which consumes far more energy than Poland does, has zero of them. Italy gets 40% of its fuel from Russia. So for Poland, it's not that big a deal. This is more of a shot across the bow. It's not entirely clear what Vladimir Putin gets out of demanding payment for oil in rubles or energy in rubles. But it's more the ability to tell these countries we can actually do this. Now, he's starting with countries that don't depend on it as much. It is very dangerous for Russia, which gets more than 40% of its, you know, its foreign reserves from selling energy, to play this game, because all these other countries already want to get off Russian energy, but they can't do it as fast as Bulgaria or Poland can. This may just force their hand. If all of a sudden we can't get the natural gas to start with, then we should increase our speed at which we can get it from somewhere else. And there are other suppliers lining up. The main issue is logistics. How do you change your supplier of natural gas and other forms of energy? It's hard to do in a hurry.
So talk more about that, because the long-term plan, the strategy in Europe is to end its dependence on Russia for gas. But how is it possible to do that quickly? I mean, you know, within months or even weeks here.
So, you know, oil and coal, which are the other two things they sell, you can move that around quickly because you can put it on a ship and send it anywhere there's a port. Natural gas has to be liquefied, sent on particular ships, of which there aren't a whole bunch of extra ones lying around, and they have to be sent from and to specifically built ports for receiving and sending natural gas. And that's part of the problem. The export terminals around the world are running at full capacity right now, so there isn't extra place where you can put natural gas on. There's lots of extra natural gas. It's just hard to get it there. And in the case of Germany and other countries, there's not a single receiving port to get it. So they're going to try and accelerate. And America has helped. They've said they'll help do it. Qatar, a big natural gas exporter, has also said they'll help people build the ports, but it's a big infrastructure build. You can't do this stuff in less than, let's say, a year at best. And sometimes it's several years.
So is it sustainable then for Russia to stop selling gas to Europe? You know, won't its own economy take a hit without that income? About 30 seconds, Ali.
Yeah, I think Russia's economy is already taking the hit. So this is more of a muscle flexing to show people at home that Russia's got some sway over the world. Ultimately, it's very bad for Russia. They'll find other buyers for the natural gas. India seems to be willing to buy every last drop of it, and so will China. So in the end, it will hurt. Russia will be able to sell its fuel. It'll do so at a discount, and everybody's getting hurt in the process.
Ali Velshi, anchor and economics correspondent at MSNBC. As always, Ali, thanks.
My pleasure.
Across this country, some children have easy access to guns. They may find them on a counter, in a drawer, under a bed, at a friend's house. And when those children pick up a gun, they can accidentally kill themselves or someone else. In 2020, firearms were the leading cause of death for children, surpassing car crashes for the first time in 60 years. For more, we're joined now by Lisa Vitale. She's the program manager for the Trauma, Burn, and Injury Prevention Program at Children's Hospital of Michigan. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So sadly, firearm deaths have been on the rise since the beginning of the pandemic. Have you seen this reflected at the hospital?
Yes, this has definitely been reflected here at our hospital in Detroit. The same with everybody else kind of around the country. We saw our penetrating injuries by guns rise significantly, about 30 to 40%.
Are most of these shootings accidental?
Most of the shootings are accidental. Yes, kids getting into guns that are unlocked or inadvertently left out or in reach of them, yes.
You're saying that kids will accidentally come upon a gun, right, and maybe don't realize it's loaded. Is that the most typical situation in which a child gets injured or killed by a firearm?
It is the most typical situation, yes. We see a lot of children who, if their family members keep guns under the bed or under their pillows or sitting on a bedside table, or we've had children find unlocked guns in pockets of jackets that they get into and unfortunately then, you know, get the gun and pull the trigger on themselves. We also see, we also see that someone else in the room, another child, has gotten into the gun and accidentally fires the gun, injuring another child in the room.
And then after a child is shot, you're the one that has to go and speak to the family. What do you say?
You know what? You just have to be very upfront, empathetic with them, be sympathetic to the situation that they're in. You'll find most family members really want to do the right thing and keep their kids safe and prevent this from happening again, because a lot of our families use guns as protection and they don't think about the unintentional consequences of having an unlocked firearm.
We're not realistically going to change whether or not parents own guns or whether they keep them in their homes. According to Everytown for Gun Safety, which is an advocacy group, an estimated 5.4 million children live in homes where there's at least one loaded and unlocked gun.
Correct.
So what can we do to prevent these injuries and these deaths?
The most important thing, and we can't stress enough, and this is what we talk to parents about all the time, is really just storing your guns safely. Keeping them in cases or safes, kind of out of the way of children or not in an area where they're really going to notice. We ourselves give out trigger locks to families. Another thing is that they can store the ammunition away from the gun. If the patient does get into the gun, if they fire it, there won't be any bullets in the gun.
You know, that message has been relayed for a number of years now, and I'm wondering if you've learned over your time working with these kinds of injuries and deaths, what have you learned about how to get that message through? I mean, because there's parents, I'm sure every parent is stunned and shocked when an injury like this occurs and has a feeling of regret, perhaps, if there was a gun left unlocked. How might we better relay this message?
Of course. I think falls into, it'll never happen to me, or, you know, that's kind of the impossible mentality. But really, it can happen to anyone, and it does. We see it time and time again. It does not discriminate. If a gun is unlocked and a child finds it, they're going to find a way to pull the trigger. So really not polarizing the situation and just talking openly about it, and really allowing families to be honest that they need to do better in their safe gun storage practices and really giving them the resources to do that.
this is pretty grim work. I mean, how do you cope with continuing to deal with these kind of situations and the injuries and deaths of children?
You know, I really look at it as these children need somebody, and I am happy to be that somebody for them. And I think that's kind of where we get gratification from our job and are able to keep going and keep doing it.
Lisa Vitale is program manager for the Trauma, Burn, and Injury Prevention Program at Children's Hospital of Michigan. Lisa, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Our next story sounds a little like the plot of a spy novel, but it's very real and sheds some light on why the early days of Russia's invasion of Ukraine didn't go exactly to plan. Back in February, when Russian forces were headed towards Kyiv, a group of saboteurs in Belarus gummed up the works. They targeted the railway links between Russia and Ukraine through Belarus and managed to disrupt Russia's supply lines. Liz Sly has been reporting on this. She covers global affairs for our editorial partner, The Washington Post, and is based in London. Hi, Liz.
Hello.
So, going back to February, before Russian troops had crossed the border, some in Belarus took quick action. What did they do?
Well, yes, these are a group of activists. It's all very amorphous. There's no formal structure. But in 2020, when there were pro-democracy protests against the president in Belarus, Lukashenko, a number of ad hoc groups formed to oppose him. And these groups came together as the Russian invasion was gearing up and beginning to try and block the Russian troops from staying in Belarus and invading Ukraine. The first thing that happened was that a group of cyber activists managed to hack into the Belarus railway system. And they caused havoc with the scheduling. People had to do it manually. Not all the Belarus railway officials that know how to manually program the schedules. And that slowed things down. Then on the night after the invasion, the first night of the invasion that had happened that day, other groups involving railway workers, disgruntled security officials, clubbed together to commit sabotage on the lines. And they disabled or they set fire to signaling boxes, and this caused further chaos for the Russians just as they were hurtling into Ukraine with the expectation of sweeping into the capital.
I found it amusing in your reporting, one of the hackers said it was easy to hack in because the railway company was still using Windows XP circa 2001 or so. How effective were these efforts?
Well, I think they were massively effective. I mean, we saw huge problems for the Russian force the minute it hit Ukraine. For example, there was an airborne assault on the airport at Hostomel outside Ukraine. Paratroopers swarmed in from helicopters and seized control of the airport. Now, in a normal operation like that, you would have infantry and armor coming up behind you on the road to protect you and reinforce you. That infantry and armor didn't arrive. Within a couple of days, the Ukrainians had taken that airport back. The Russians took it back again, but they had been slowed. The momentum was lost. And basically, they fought a couple of miles outside that airport for the rest of the month that they were in the vicinity. And then they had to pull out. Eventually, they were unable to go any further. And I suspect that these Belarus saboteurs played a bigger role in causing that initial chaos, which slowed Russia down enormously, just when it was expecting to sweep forward in a big rush of blitz war, more than we realize.
So you report that the people behind this effort were inspired by something that happened during World War II, when Belarusians who opposed the Nazis engaged in something that was known as the Rail War. Now, I understand this is a story that's well known in Belarus, but I had never heard of this. What was the Rail War?
The Germans occupied Belarus during the Second World War, and Belarusians who opposed the Nazi presence in their country began acts of sabotage, acts of resistance. They did quite a lot of acts of resistance, but the rail war was deemed incredibly successful. They basically completely disabled the German supply lines. And yes, this is this rail war, this particular part of the resistance that was formed against the Nazis, is known as the Rail War. The railway partisans are legendary in in Belarus history. So the people who were involved in these acts of sabotage tell me it really wasn't a sort of difficult idea to come up with, that you would sabotage the railways once again.
So authorities in Belarus have tried to find the people behind the recent sabotage. Have they been successful in doing that?
Yes, and this is a sad part of the story. I gather they brought drones in to surveil the lines, and they did manage to track down three alleged saboteurs. And what we know, because they put this video footage on state TV, is that they shot them in the knees, which, of course, is an extremely serious and debilitating injury. And they showed footage of guys being treated with bandages around their knees. One of them looked to be in very poor shape. Those guys have now been taken away. We don't know what happened to them, but it's definitely had a dampening effect on the sabotage operation.
And yet you say a new phase in this rail war might be underway. What do you mean?
We do know that there's been some sabotage attacks just on the other side of Ukraine's eastern border with Russia, inside Russia. Now, it's not clear to me entirely whether this could be like local Russians doing some sabotage. And the Belarusians tell me that they have been able to infiltrate people into Russia because Belarus has an open border with Russia, and that they have carried out those acts of sabotage. But that seems to be in the earlier stages, and there isn't as much information yet available on that as we have on Belarus.
Liz Sly covers global affairs for our editorial partner, The Washington Post, based out of London. Liz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and one goal is to educate. Writer Peter Cease is introducing the subject to children in his new book. It's called Nikki and Vera, A Quiet Hero of the Holocaust and the Children He Rescued. It tells the true story of the Englishman Nicholas Winton, who saved nearly 670 children from the Nazis. NPR's Elizabeth Blair tells us more.
On the cover of Nikki and Vera, a little girl stands alone on the platform of an enormous train station, holding a little suitcase and a kitty cat stuffed animal. Vera loves cats. Inside the silhouette of the girl, Peter Cease drew colorful details of what she left behind: her mom and dad, her house, a galloping horse. At the beginning of the story, Vera is living a happy life in Czechoslovakia.
They were one of the few Jewish families in town. It made no difference. They were all friends.
When Nikki Winton was a boy, he liked math, raising pigeons, and fencing. Peter Cease's artwork blends the details of everyday life with imaginative, whimsical flourishes. Holding a sword, dressed in knight's armor, little Nikki rides an enormous pigeon. When he grows up, he becomes a banker. The Nazis are swarming Europe. Winton sees the dangers and tries to help families in Czechoslovakia get their children to safety.
Nikki set up an office in a hotel in Prague. He made lists of children, he took their photographs, he found train connections. Spies kept watch.
Winton worked quickly to find foster families for hundreds of children, including Vera.
The day came for Vera to leave. She packed her clothes, she said goodbye to her grandparents, she said goodbye to her cousins, who were to follow her to England on a later train.
The train with Vera's cousins and 250 other children never made it. Her cousins and parents were sent to concentration camps.
When the war was over, Vera went back to her town. Her family was gone.
Were you concerned that the subject matter would be too dark for small children?
It was dark. It was at some moments I didn't know how to go on.
Like Vera, Peter Cease is from Czechoslovakia. To help him in those dark moments and to keep the book suitable for young children, he focused on Nicholas Winton.
He was always trying to find some positive way how to approach life. And he did lots of good in the moment when he could do it, and he never talked about it.
For decades, Nicholas Winton didn't talk about the hundreds of children he saved, nor did the children know who was responsible for their survival, until 1988. In a now famous broadcast, the BBC created a surprise reunion of sorts. Winton sits in the front row of a theater full of people.
Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please?
Everyone stands up, including Vera Gissing. Today, she is 92 years old with advanced stage dementia. After the war, she married and raised three children.
I wouldn't be here if it weren't for his actions.
Vera's daughter, Nicola Gissing, is delighted with what Peter Cease has done with the story. There are a number of books about Winton, but this is the first children's book to bring her mother's childhood in Czechoslovakia to life.
And there's her parents, and there's her with the cats, and how she loved the horses. And then the next page with her almost blind grandmother. And these are all things I've been brought up with as well. And, you know, to see it illustrated is, it's made me very emotional, but in a nice way.
Nicola Gissing says she also remembers being very young when her mother told her about some of the horrific things that happened to people during the Holocaust.
I was always scared it might happen again because, you know, this happened because my grandparents were Jewish, mum was Jewish, and I'm Jewish by birthright. So I actually had a bag of my own provisions hidden at the back of the airing cupboard in case the Nazis came. Mum didn't realise this till we were adults, and I told her once, and she said maybe she shouldn't have spoken so openly.
Gissing believes Peter Cease has done a good job keeping the Holocaust age appropriate, with details children can relate to and without making it too frightening. Donna Matthews, a developmental psychologist, agrees.
The focus of this story is on Nikki and on Vera, these two people. It's not on the horrors of the Holocaust. The Holocaust is a background for the story.
Matthews adds that Nikki and Vera is a good early entry point to the Holocaust for kids because it shows the importance of inclusion and respect for diverse others. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You may have seen Shohei Ohtani of the LA Angels. He's a pitching and hitting sensation in Major League Baseball. But he's already being eclipsed by the next big thing in Japan. NPR's Tom Goldman tells us about a 20-year-old pitcher who stunned the baseball world this month.
Last Sunday, superhuman Roki Sasaki was merely human. He pitched five innings for his Chiba Lotte Marines. He struck out four, walked three, gave up two runs, but got the win. A solid effort, but compared to what he'd done the previous 2 weeks, utterly pedestrian. On April 10th, Sasaki pitched the Japanese Major League's first perfect game in 28 years. He was breathtaking in not allowing a single opponent to get on base, striking out 19 of the 27 batters he faced. Afterwards, Sasaki had a press conference on the field. His questioner asked, "Many fans are hoping there's more to come. What do you say to them?" "I'm going to keep trying my best," Sasaki said, "to pitch just as well the next time out." A young man of his word, a week later, Sasaki pitched perfectly again into the eighth inning. But opposing batters were making good contact and his pitch count was getting high. So his manager, who has protected Sasaki like a rare jewel, pulled him from the game. Jim Allen lives in Japan and has written about baseball there for nearly 30 years.
The thing that shocked me the most was the lack of outrage.
The outrage of sitting a pitcher when he's this close to a perfect game, considered a once-in-a-lifetime achievement. But in this case, it was taking out a pitcher on the cusp of a second perfect game in a row. With Sasaki, Allen says, the calculus of once-in-a-lifetime has changed.
The way he pitched on April 10th, we got a sensation that this is not the end, that this is the beginning, and that this is something that is a very real possibility every time he pitches.
Sasaki has been on baseball's radar since he was a high school senior throwing close to 100 miles per hour. But managers and coaches have brought him along slowly, not wanting to burn him out or overwork a young man still physically developing. His first year professionally, he didn't pitch. His second year, appearances were limited. And now, year three?
I've been watching all his starts. They're just electric.
Allen says Japanese media want to know everything about Sasaki, including his sad past. His father and two other relatives died when their home was washed away in the 2011 tsunami.
She said, you know, it's something that will never be erased from my memory. And I want people to know that this is still a thing, you know, that people are still unable to return to their homes.
But Alan says Sasaki doesn't wear the tragedy on his sleeve and handles the constant questions about his dad in a calm and understated way, kind of the way he mows down opposing batters with an effortless and efficient delivery that belies the ferocity of his blazing fastball and confounding split-finger pitch. It's unlikely he'll make the jump to the U.S. for several years, which is why Major League scouts are okay with the take-it-slowly approach. After Sunday's wins, Sasaki was temporarily deactivated, more protection, but when he makes his next start, batters are sure to shudder while fans dream of what's next. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Firefighters from Arizona to Florida are battling wildfires that have already burned more than 1,300 square miles this year, a 30% increase over the 10-year average. Those include the 30-square-mile tunnel fire just outside of Flagstaff, Arizona. After more than a week, it's about 30% contained, and locals have been given the okay to return to the homes they evacuated. But for some, there are no homes to return to. Among them is Kathy Oliver. She ran the Sacred Peaks Equine Sanctuary, a not-for-profit horse rescue from her Flagstaff home, which is now a pile of charred beams and ashes. She joins us now. And Kathy, we're so grateful to have you and so sorry for all you have lost.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with what you're calling the good news. You managed an unbelievable feat. You saved all 21 of your horses and some dogs and cats and donkeys, but you had an incredibly short amount of time to do that. Describe the scene for us. You and some friends and neighbors all worked together really quickly.
We did. We actually started evacuating well before we were required to, because the winds were bad and I know how high the danger is, and had so many of it animals to evacuate. So people started contacting me, and I had some help from some volunteers and neighbors that helped get horses loaded in trailers. We did get all of the animals out safely with all the help. It was chaotic and it went really fast.
Well, and as you were loading the last of those animals, you said you could feel the heat of the fire on you. You sent us some videos showing the massive billowing clouds of smoke and flames, and we'll share them on our website. But describe what you were seeing, Kathy, and how fast that fire was moving.
Yes, it was. I had just a couple horses. By then, the ones that were left in the pens were pretty wound up with all the other horses being gone and them being left behind. Took a little more time to catch, but the last horse I went to get, I knew the fire was close, and I was very focused on what I was doing. I wasn't really watching it, but there were flames right outside my property, which was, you know, maybe 100 feet. A lot of smoke, a lot of noise from the fire. And when I went to catch that last horse, I just noticed how much heat there was coming from the fire. And I knew, but the firefighters had been telling us for about 10 minutes that we really needed to get out. It was very close.
You must have been terrified.
I was, but honestly, I was so focused on what I was doing. I just was focused on getting it done.
Tell us about the house that you lost. And you lost another building, a workshop space where you were storing your hay. I know this
right.
is really an expensive loss. Tell us about what's gone.
Okay, well, I'll start with the hay barn. It was about a 30 by 60 foot metal building, really nice and really handy to have here on the property. I stored 1,000 bales of hay in there at a time. I'd buy it in the summer when it was cheapest, and once the hay caught on fire inside, there was a lot of heat. There's just about a 3 foot deep pile of ash. The other major loss, of course, was the house, which is a little more emotional for me, but it was a beautiful timber frame house with beautiful views and a neat 1899 Summit Oak wood stove. Just a real rustic, cozy, really beautiful place. And I'm going to miss it, that's for sure. And of course, I've grabbed very few belongings. I really needed to spend my time getting the animals out. So most everything I had in there is gone.
And you're living in your trailer now, back on your property. Can you care for your horses with no power? It looks like your water source is a little iffy, too.
The water is certainly a major issue right now. You know, I hauled some in initially, and as I'm continuing to bring more horses back, I've got 4 horses and 2 of the donkeys here right now, and then my dogs and all my chickens, which we also evacuated and got back. So
wow.
The horses are the big water users, though.
I know you were worried that this was going to happen eventually, this fire, and just a few months ago, you increased your insurance coverage. Will you stay on the property, or has this region become really unsustainable for human habitation?
You know, I think that's a good question. I do plan to stay here, certainly for now, to rebuild. I do hope to, you know, rebuild with a fireproof house, do more water collection, do solar. Really, I can certainly see what burnt and what didn't. I do plan on staying here for the short run, although it's going to just, sadly, continue to get worse, and it looks like so.
Right, because it seems there's not a fire season anymore. These are year-round events.
Yep, that's true. And it's the last few years have been so dry. We're not really getting much relief.
What's next for your neighbors in this area? It sounds like y'all are supporting each other. Will people stay? Will they rebuild?
I think most people are staying. I haven't talked to anybody yet that isn't rebuilding. I have 6 neighbors just, you know, within sight of me here that lost their homes. And yeah, as far as I know, they're all rebuilding, but probably about half of those are second homes. So it affects them a little differently.
Yeah. Well, we wish you all the best, Kathy. You take care.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
That's Flagstaff resident Kathy Oliver, who lost her home in the tunnel fire that is now 30% contained.
Reservoirs are an important but controversial part of moving water around some of the driest areas. And in the foothills of northern Colorado, a massive one is under construction. Alex Hager of the Mountain West News Bureau has the story.
Just north of Denver, in the foothills near Loveland, is a striking example of mankind's ability to reshape the natural world. I was one of those kids who was really into trucks, and the Tonka-loving toddler in me was in awe at the bulldozers, dump trucks, and excavators so big they could dig the foundation of a house in just 3 scoops. Joe Donnelly is the project manager.
We're filling 100-ton trucks, and we need to haul a load of rock, place on the dam every 2 minutes, 5 days a week, for 2.5 years.
You can probably tell by now, this build is huge. We're gazing up past hard hats and piles of dirt, up some 300 feet to the tops of dusty red cliffs that will someday loom over the dam that created this giant man-made lake. Also high is the cost of this project.
The reservoir here at Chimney Hollow is going to cost about $500 million. And so when you break that over the 4-year construction span, it ends up being $340,000 a day.
Jeff Stala is a spokesman for Northern Water, the agency running this site. Between permits and blueprints, the process to get this project built is taking more than 20 years. Stala says it's needed for rapid growth in cities north of Denver.
This is going to be a water source in northern Colorado well into the 21st century. We're thinking generationally and decades down the road with this.
Stala says the future is rife with uncertainty, and this reservoir is designed to store water as insurance for the dry times. But if you look farther upstream, Jen Pels with the conservation group Wild Earth Guardians says there's an even deeper uncertainty about how long the water will last.
Spending a bunch of money on a reservoir when you don't have the water to fill it is kind of silly. I heard someone had a great quote around a refrigerator that's empty doesn't do a lot of good to solve, you know, someone's hunger crisis.
Colorado is built on moving water around. In this state, about 80% of the water falls on the west side of the mountains, but about 80% of its people live on the east side. With more than 2 decades of drought straining the Colorado River, which provides so much of that water, some are pushing back on new infrastructure that could strain it even further. Ken Fusick is vice president of the Upper Colorado River Watershed Group.
You can't continue to add population without providing them water. We will all recognize that. But where's that water going to come from? There's only so much. We are a finite resource.
Fusick says straining that finite resource where it starts can cause real, tangible harm, like algae blooms and threats to the economies that depend on water for recreation. And those same gripes are likely to be brought up against any future proposed reservoirs in the area. As more people move to the area and demand more water, will they be able to get it? Again, Jeff Stala with Northern Water.
If we're going to be able to exist and offer the same opportunities to our children and grandchildren on the Front Range, we should consider, and we're doing it here, capture the water when it's available so that we have flexibility in those years when we don't have it.
But it'll be a while before the Chimney Hollow Reservoir has the chance to do that. 4 more years of construction, 3 years of filling it with water, and unpredictable changes to the climate and drought stand between today and this water finding its way to the homes down below. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Hager in Loveland, Colorado.
The world's largest gathering of indigenous peoples is happening in New York this week. It's the first summit of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues since before the pandemic. In the U.S., Native American leaders are calling on the federal government to give tribal nations more say in what happens to their land. Kristen Carpenter joins us now for more. She's director of the American Indian Law Program at the University of Colorado Boulder. And Kristen, in the U.S. right now, there's a battle over whether the federal government can take action on Native land without the consent of tribal leaders. There seems to be a disconnect between the rights the international community affords to Indigenous people and what happens in the U.S. Why the disconnect?
Great question. Well, in the United States, the standard is that the federal government must consult with American Indian tribes before taking measures that would adversely affect their sacred lands. But consultation can be just a conversation that the federal government is then entitled to ignore. So often an Indian tribe will indicate that a certain development project will desecrate their sacred lands, and the federal agency decides to go ahead with it anyway. The international standard is higher. It requires that national governments consult with tribes, but also receive their free, prior, and informed consent. That is, negotiate a mutually binding agreement before moving ahead with those kinds of development projects. And the consent standard is one that can actually make sure that governments protect the fundamental human rights of Indigenous peoples, things like religious freedom or the right to life or the right to culture.
So the U.S. voted against the International Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples when it was first adopted by the UN in 2007, has since reversed its position. I know the declaration isn't legally binding, but are there methods for enforcing it?
There are, and the current moment in international Indigenous peoples' human rights is really about implementing the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I work with the Native American Rights Fund on an initiative called the Implementation Project that is meant to do just what you're talking about, pressure the United States to put those articles of the Declaration into practice in a number of spheres, whether it's development or child welfare or religious freedom.
So we're talking about declarations and international communities. How does this actually look on the ground? You point to protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock as an example of how this goes wrong, and also this fight between the Apache tribe and some members of the Navajo tribe in Arizona over the government's transfer of land to a copper mining company. Can you explain how this connects to these international declarations we've been talking about?
Yes, and I think it's notable that there are more U.S. tribal leaders at the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues than ever before, and I think tribal leaders are realizing that our standards are inadequate in the United States and that we really need to work together to bring the human rights principles home. the way it works on the ground, and I just attended a meeting with the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission and 12 other tribes on sacred sites diplomacy, is that these tribes, tribal governments, are all calling for the federal government, whether it's the United States Forest Service or the Park Service, to consult with them and arrive at agreements to mutually determine the terms of any development project affecting sacred sites. So that might be not to develop parts of it out of respect for the religion. It might be to delay certain activities seasonally to allow tribes to conduct their ceremonies. There are all sorts of particular terms that could really help to meet the human rights of indigenous peoples here in the U.S.
Why does the U.S. drag its feet on so many of these international compacts and declarations related to indigenous peoples?
You know, it's hard to say because the United States is such a leader in human rights generally, and indigenous peoples around the world look to the United States to fulfill that role in the indigenous people's space. But unfortunately, it really doesn't, or at least it has an opportunity to do a much better job in that respect. In the United States, international law maybe isn't as salient as it is in some other countries, but also we have a large body of federal Indian law that, to be candid, doesn't meet the international human rights standards. So I think the United States is worried in some respects about additional obligations that it's going to have to accept if it brings our law up to those international standards. Federal law allows the government to destroy Indian sacred sites and destroy Indian religions. I think most U.S. citizens might be surprised to learn that because we all believe so much in the freedom of religion. So it's absolutely the right thing to do for the United States to get on board with the standards of the Declaration. I believe it's going to, and I hope it'll start to happen more quickly.
Kristen Carpenter is director of the American Indian Law Program at the University of Colorado Boulder. Thank you so much, Kristen.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. It's good to have you with us. You're listening to Here and Now.